So I just want to give you a little background to how I'm going to preach today. It is going to be a little bit different than what you're used to. That should be fine. It'll be a little bit maybe more similar in the vein of roughshod last week. So I want to tell some stories, actually two in particular. Over the last few weeks with YWAM, so I work with YWAM, we've had two teachers come and teach on our discipleship training course. One did a workshop on storytelling because we run an arts-focused kind of training program. And he did a whole thing on storytelling and why we tell stories and how we tell stories. And then on our final week of the discipleship training school, we had a teacher come and speak on evangelism. And he did a lot on storytelling again. And particularly, we looked at kind of the life of Jesus and looked at how he kind of told about the kingdom, told about who God was, and did it through kind of parables and short stories. And then on top of that, with Thy Kingdom Come the last few weeks, being out in the streets and doing stuff, I thought a lot about how do we share the good news? How do we communicate and actually talk? And it made me, I've just been thinking a lot about stories and how we communicate good news. And so for me, today's a little bit of an experiment. I'm trying something. I've never really done something this style per se, especially in this context. So I just encourage you to kind of just get into the story and just kind of go with it, enjoy it, and we'll see how it goes. So I want to tell you a story about a boy named Michael. And as I kind of share his story, I want you to try and think, what would it be like to be Michael? He was a good kid, didn't really get up to too much trouble, had a loving kind of family. His dad was Jason, and his mom was Sophie, and they were good parents. They were like a fairly well-off family, you know, not like the richest of rich, not the poorest of poor, just the kind of good middle-class family. Kind of normal lives, lived in suburbia kind of thing. He went to a decent school. There was nothing kind of out of the norm wrong. And like all kids and all families and all parents' situations, one day they had a fight. There was disagreements, there was arguments. And Michael decided that for whatever reason, based on even the things that had gone on in his life before and all the good stuff, he decided he wasn't happy with the situation. And he kind of wanted to show his parents right, that he could defend for himself or that they were wrong and he was right and he didn't need them. And he decided to run away. And as he ran away, you know, I don't know if he thought that it was going to be for a season. I don't know if he thought it, you know, I don't know what was going on. If he thought, oh, maybe one day I'll come back. But it was just, I need to get out, and I don't want to be a part of this family. They're mean, they're cruel, whatever. And as he was out on the streets, he'd gotten a bus ticket and gone to kind of the local city, which wasn't far away. And as he was out on the streets, he got kidnapped. And with the kidnapping situation, you know, he was taken away from his family. He was kind of scared and shocked and didn't know what was happening. Forced to kind of stay in a dark room in a basement that was locked up. And had a captor who, for all intents and purposes, had evil intents. As captives go and these situations happen, he was faced with all kind of forms of abuse. You know, physical stuff. He faced kind of emotional abuse. There was psychological damage. You know, stuff that really crushes the soul and the spirit of a person. And in that dark room and in those solace and in those times of loneliness and fear and unsure of what was going on, he would think about his parents. And sometimes he would remember the good, but on other times he felt betrayed. He wondered where they were. He wondered what they were doing and why they weren't saving him. He wondered if they really truly loved him, because if they loved him, how come they haven't come and got him? How come they haven't saved him? And over and over, as time went on and kind of months went on and months turned into a year or so, he started to forget kind of who his parents were. And he could kind of have, he kind of had these, if he could remember, when he did kind of think of them and this vaguely team, he just thought about how awful they were, because how could they let him be in this situation? And he was torn inside and devastated, wanting to be free, but also kind of not knowing, almost to the point where being alone for so long, other than times when he saw his captor, kind of just, you know, didn't, kind of almost reality got lost in the midst of it, you know? And as time went on, and as science kind of shows and talks, something started to happen, which is called the Stockholm Syndrome, where he started to believe that actually his captor was his friend, or at least that his cap, there was a friendship that started to form. There was an admiration. He looked up to his captor, and unbeknownst to him, he was being groomed for this. And as time went on, and kind of as we got into about a year or two, 3 years of being captured, he started then being taken out into the streets and into cities. And kind of if he obeyed or if he did what he was assigned to do, he would get rewards. Short-term, temporary rewards that would feel amazing, but, you know, stuff that would it kind of only increase him to want to do more and win the approval of his captor more and more and more. Eventually, after I think it was about five, six years of being captive, his captor then started using him to recruit others and to get other kids to come in and be a part of this community. And in a lot of ways, what was happening, it was a lot of it was focused on kind of crime across the city. So these boys were used for robberies and other ways of kind of stealing stuff and getting money, and it became like this little underground crime syndicate, which was based on the power of this captive. And Michael actually was became almost like a secondhand man to this guy. He had power over some of the other boys, and he kind of thrived in it. He kind of loved it. And at the same time, in himself, he felt sick about it. Like there was this tension. On one hand, you know, being in this situation, it's a defense mechanism. It's how do I survive? And so on one hand, there was this sense of power and excitement and freedom that he felt. But on the other side, there was this sickening and just disgust in himself that somehow deep down, he didn't like to look at it often, but deep down realized that actually he was destroying other people's lives. And he knew it, but would kind of try and block that out any way, shape, or form. And at some point later on over the season, it ends up being quite a random circumstance, but one day, all of a sudden, there was loud, angry shouts, there was noise, it was traumatic, there was screaming going on, he didn't know what was going on, and it was dark, and they were in the basement, and all of a sudden, his door opened up, lights came in, police were there, and he was blinded and shocked and was confused, and they were saying he was all right, he's free now, and he was kind of going, what am I free from? You know, like, what are you doing? Why are you taking me away from this place? You know, it wasn't the reaction that you thought. He was, it kind of like World War II, I've heard that, when the Allies came in and they tried to free the Jewish prisoners, that they actually had to then re-prison them because they couldn't deal with being free. And it was the same kind of thing that went on. He didn't know how to be free, and he was fighting them and saying, leave me alone, this is where I belong, and stop, and take me away. Don't take me away. He was reunited with his dad. It was a little strange and something that wasn't normal. It was different in that it was his dad and also a new mom now. So his mom, Sophia, was no longer there, and his dad had remarried to a lady named Olivia. And he was angry about this, and he couldn't believe his dad would do this. And he, as he struggled to be home and kind of reacquainting with who these people were, and his this new relationship with his dad and this new mom or this new wife, and he just was confused, and he would rebel out, and he would do, you know, he would kick and scream and sometimes get violent. But his kind of dad and his stepmom just continued to walk with him, and they knew it was going to be a long process, and they knew it was going to take time, and they, you know, they worked, they got him counseling, they worked on it, and they just consistently demonstrated love after love after love after love, forgiveness after forgiveness after forgiveness after forgiveness. I think it was about 5 years after him being freed, one day he came in and he sat down beside his dad and he gave him a hug. And they just sat and they held each other for a while and they started to cry and they started to cry and they cried and they cried. And his dad looked over him and he said, "Son, I love you. This is now the start of your life." Cool. I want to stop there. So that's story one. I want you to get into groups and I want you to talk, I want you to kind of discuss. Let me just look. Oh, sorry, I forgot one thing. That's right. When he got out of prison, or when he'd gotten out of the captivity, he had to go before the courts because he'd been involved in all this crime syndicate. And when he went before the judge, kind of fearing going to prison and kind of being locked up again, or at least in a worse lockup, the judge deemed them not guilty. And the reason that he stated was that because of these circumstances and the Stockholm Syndrome was that these boys, the crimes that they had committed weren't who they were, but that they were done under kind of manipulation and in a situation where they were unable to make healthy choices. Does that make sense? And so part of the counseling that came in and other stuff was because they were allowed to be free, but they had to kind of work to prove that they were going to grow and heal and that kind of stuff. And if they went back to the crime, that's when they would be kind of arrested. So what I want you to do as breakout kind of groups, I want you to take some time and I want you to ask, you know, if this is a story that kind of reflects the gospel, where do you connect with this story? What part of Michael's story do you feel, I relate to this with my walk of with understanding God? Is that cool? Take kind of 5-10 minutes and have a chat about how does that impact us? Okay, if we could come back. Is there anything that anyone wants to feed back or kind of share with the group? You don't have to, but... Anyone else? Okay. So now I want to tell a second story. This time I want to tell you about Jason. So Jason's Michael's dad and Sophia, his wife. They only had one child, Michael. He was like their pride and joy. They loved him very dearly. Jason was a little bit of a crazy dad sometimes, you know, on the football game. Come on, you can do it better. Went a little dad crazy on the sports field. It happens. I've been there, which is sad for having a 3-year-old and you think, oh, I really need to work on that. They loved him and they cared for him deeply. And kind of Jason running off is something they never would have kind of thought they could have ever seen happening or would have ever expected it to happen. You know, they thought he was loved. They thought he knew he was loved. You know, having a row was a part of kind of normal family life. And just kind of, I guess in a sense, would have expected it kind of happened as a kind of a small kind of inclination. But when he first ran off, they kind of didn't know what to do or how to process it. And at first they were thought, oh, he's just trying to punish us or put a fear into us or trying to take power over the situation. And Jason really was trying to calm his wife, going, it's all right. He's just tempting us. He'll come back. It will be all right. And kind of as hours started to go by, you know, this pit in their stomachs, just something was off. Something was wrong. They tried calling the police as it got up to like 6 hours, and obviously the police are like, we can't really do anything until they're gone for the recommended time. They started getting in their cars and driving around and seeing if they could find him, and they called friends up and tried to see if they could help out, and they had kind of a search committee, as you know, we were getting into kind of 12 plus hours because they were getting nervous. Sophie was in the car panicking at times, so eventually Jason took her home and said, look, you need to stay at home and do what you need to do, but it's too crazy with you in the car panicking, so I need to be able to focus and search. And she was all right with that, and they just started searching and searching and searching and doing everything and trying to get as many friends and family as they could involved in. As they hit the recommended time, they got a hold of the police, and the police, you know, they formed a committee of what needed to happen, and they kind of tried to, as much as possible, explain the kind of process of what would happen. You know, this next, I think it's like 24, 36 hours is really crucial in finding them. And there was this very very intentional, very committed, focused search for Michael. And they didn't sleep a lot. They were tired. They cried a lot when they had moments of peace. They struggled to sleep at night. And this search went on. And as kind of days turned into weeks, the police started to do less and less and less. And they started to panic more and more and more. And at some point, basically, they were told there's probably, at this point, not a good chance you'll ever find your son. And they were kind of devastated and cried and, you know, broken by this. And, you know, all the kind of feelings and emotions that go with that, you know, stunned, shocked, grieving, anger, denial, all those kind of things were raging on, and they just didn't kind of know what to do. And Jason just decided, we are not giving up. We are going to keep searching and searching and searching and searching. And kind of going further and further and further and further. And obviously bills started racking up and whatnot. And more fuel costs and more searches. And then they decided actually, him and Sophie got down together and they talked about it. And they decided to hire a private detective to aid kind of the limiting police search. And he would still every so often be able to get friends in on weekends to go out and search. As months started to go on, they started trying to put out more and more of a media publicity. I think they put their house on a mortgage to take out money. And they just started giving everything that they could to try and find their son. At the end of the year and at this point where basically they were told, like, don't have, like, you need to let go that you may never find your son again. Sophie got sick. And I don't know if it was the trauma, I don't know if there was underlying issues, but after a year of this process, I don't know, just the devastation of this year, she got sick. So over the next year, Jason dealt with this process of trying to find his son, devastated, not trying to lose hope, and also having to walk through his wife getting sick and eventually passing away at the end of the year. And in some ways, you know, that then took 6 months or a year to kind of deal with, to where he could at least be kind of somewhat normal. And in the same time, he still would go out on searches on weekend and stuff. And here was a broken dad who had lost almost everything. And one of the things that held him strong in this process is on Sophie's dying bed, she looked at him in a clear moment and said, "Do not give up on our son. As a mother, I am telling you he's still alive. You must find him, and I believe you will find him. Do not give up. Never give up." And so he spent kind of the next somewhat years searching and kind of always hoping. It was always in the background. He never could kind of let it go. It was never far from home. And he would search and he would search. And even when he was not searching, he was always looking. And sometimes he'd be out and he'd see a boy who looked like Jason. And he would kind of follow him and kind of stalk him, not in like an evil way, but just, "Is it my son? Is it my son? Have I found my son? Have I found my son?" And then he would find this boy and realize, "No, that's not my son," and devastation again. And this happened multiple times and almost kind of going a little crazy because he felt like he would see his son over and over and over again. And actually he got to a point where he had spent all his money that he lost his house, he lost his car, he lost everything. And he was kind of alone and devastated. And he had friends and support and people helped him out. And one of his friends said he could come live with them for a while and they took care of him. But he had given everything. He had spent everything. He had done everything. And in this process, in amongst the friends of his that were still searching, and even though a lot of them had kind of given up hope, there was one lady named Olivia who he met, and they had formed a friendship over these kind of years of searching. And for whatever reason, she really took to him, and she loved him, and she loved his kind of dedication for his son. And something in her tweaked, and he'd shared stories about his previous wife and the things she had said, and something really grew in her heart that, actually, I believe in this man, and I believe in his wife, and I believe we will find this kid. And she came from a fairly wealthy background, and they ended up getting married, and they searched together for the remaining kind of years of their time, and they never gave up. And on one magical day, I don't know why, I don't know how, but he was on a meeting in another town, and he was drinking his coffee in a shop, trying to prepare, and a boy walked by, a grown boy, because it's been about, I think it was about 8 to 10 years later. I'm not sure exactly what. But it looked like his son. And he dropped everything, went out of the meeting, and he followed this boy. And his boy had looked at him, kind of unbeknownst to him, and he was like, "I'm sure this is my boy." And he took some photos, and he kind of stalked him to where he was going and found the house where he's at. And he rushed home and he got the police and he searched and they did pleases and they did like photo scans and they were like, "Yeah, we think this might be your son." And they went in and they raided and they found his son. And it was kind of a shock and kind of, it was incredible and this mixed emotion and a kind of, can this be normal again? Can we be father and son again? Will he accept me? Will he see me differently? Will he see me for who I am? Will he be able to accept my love? Will he be able to see me as dad again? And then kind of in sheer horror going, how will he do with the loss of his mom? And how will he accept my new wife? And there was nervousness and fears and emotions. And they got their son home, and it was strange. It kind of didn't feel right at first. In one sense, he was home, but on another sense, he wasn't home. And it was like they had a stranger in their house who they were trying to educate him again on, this is what it means to be a part of family again. And it was like bringing a foreigner in, someone who is different than his son, and saying, I accept you. You are my son. And kind of no matter what happened, no matter how bad it got, they just combined force, him and his wife. We love you. This is your home. This is your family. This is where you belong. Olivia was a bit of a different situation because obviously this wasn't her son. And she said, look, I understand the kind of terrors of your situation. I understand that you don't accept me or that you may not want me here. And I understand that. But I will be here for you no matter what. And you are my, I want to be a place of home for you. I want you to feel welcome here. I will not tread on your space. I will give you space as you need, but I will be dedicated to loving you as if you are my own child. And obviously he brushed that off and didn't care and whatever. But over time and over these 5 years, they slowly worked at him. And it was like talking to ice, you know, like stone cold. They didn't feel like they were getting anywhere. They didn't feel like anything was happening. And one day, actually, he sat down with Olivia and he said, I don't know why, but I feel home with you. I feel safe with you. And I feel at peace with you. And that's all he said. They didn't hug, but she was like, okay, something's changing. And her and Jason talked together. And they started working really hard, and they started thinking, okay, we've made some ground here. And so they started trying to do more family events and trying to do kind of really intentional family times and going on vacations and going on doing stuff and really getting to know each other. And they started having conversations and they started talking more and a relationship was starting to build. Until this one fateful day when Michael sat down with Jason and said, Dad, I'm sorry. I want to be here. I want to love you. I want to know your love. I want to be family again. And they cried and they cried and they cried and they hugged and they held. And his dad turned to him and said, Michael, you have always been family. I have never not stopped searching for you. I have never stopped loving you. I have sacrificed everything you. And they shared about all the things that had gone on and all the details of everything. And it's the one thing he wanted to tell his son is, Michael, this is where it begins. This is where your life starts. This is where you can become who you really are meant to be. And I want to walk through that with you. I want to show you. I want to see who you are. I want to be a part of actually you having a life that is full and productive, where you can get a job and you can get married and you can have fun and you can be free and you can know no pain and you can forgive what has happened to you and you can lay that to rest and be your own person. And I want to be that dad who walks you through that and shows you what life really is. Okay, cool. Second breakout talk. I want to, just for 5 minutes, I want you to talk about what version do we see of the Father? When we see God, do we relate to Michael's version of God, where it's hard to see the goodness? Or do we see the Father's view of the Father, of I have paid everything, I have done everything? And there might be a mixture of both. But yeah, sort of 5 minutes and let's process that. So the idea that God never gives up, no matter what happens, he's always there, always through anything, he never gives up when quite easily could have. I kind of love stories because you can actually pack quite a bit into them. And there's a lot of things that are intentionally in that story. And I guess I want to leave, you know, this is our family. This is, you know, this is the good news, that we can be a part of family. And like the dad, actually, once we're part of family, that's just the start. You know? And what does that mean if that's just the start? Cool. Thank you.